Our next speakers are Bridie Paxman and Chris Day. From Seditions to Petitions, Disturbance Papers and Criminal Petitions, 1816 to 1838.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Christopher Day. I'm a reader advisor here in the Modern Domestic Records team at the National Archives. And today, my colleague Bryony and I are going to speak about, seditions and petitions. I'm going to start by talking briefly about the cataloguing we've done to the HO40 series, which is the Home Office Disturbances correspondence, which have been catalogued for the period between 1816 and 1818. And then Brian is then going to speak a little bit about the cataloguing that has been completed on the HO17 series of criminal petitions, which started in 1819. I'm going to briefly also examine some records within the HO40 series relating to the Penrich Rebellion in Derbyshire in 1817, which is sort of an infamous instance. And then Brian is actually going to have a look at a petition for someone who was involved in that rebellion later on. So HO40, I suppose it's sort of worth talking about what it is. So I suppose in this disturbances, in a sort of dictionary definition, a breakdown of law and law abiding and peaceful behaviour. And so for the Home Office's mind at this time, this sort of applies to a wide range of things. So all forms of protest, rioting, rebellions, sort of all sorts of treasonable acts. And it's really great for us as historians because it provides us with sort of a compendium of protest and riot throughout the early 19th century. So as you can see, the series runs from 1812, which is the year of the Luddite riots, up until 1855. But during this project, we've only so far catalogued one what we call sub-series, which is this first sub-series within HO40, which relates to the revival of Luddism and the formations of movements for parliamentary reform, covering a period of roughly about 1816 to 1818, maybe a little bit of stuff either side. This sub-series contains sort of 8 bundles. So if you look on the catalogue, you'd have it runs between the piece numbers HO40/3 to HO40/10. Each of these bundles contains, you know, sort of quite a few sort of either additional bundles of papers or volumes of letters. And it sort of broadly contains 2 types of records. First, it contains a series of papers that are presented to the secret committees of the Houses of Parliament in 1817. These were committees that were got up because of the government's fear of radicalism at the time, and sort of trying to make plans to try and suppress or get rid of it, and it actually led to the suspension of habeas corpus in 1817. And the second sort of broader category of records are a whole load of different reports received from magistrates, from agents, from informers, and also depositions of prisoners. So all sorts of documents relating to radicalism and the government's sort of reaction to it in the early 19th century. And so it's really good because it not only gives us an idea about the kind of protest that was going on in this period, but it also gives us an idea about how government and sort of other layers of authority throughout the country were interacting, what they knew, how they knew it, and how they acted upon this information. So why have we chosen to do 1816 to 1818? Firstly, this project is part of a wider project we're working on with Robert Poole and Katrina Navicus from the universities of Central Lancashire and Hertfordshire, respectively. Yes, but additionally, it was a really grim couple of years. The economy was really quite depressed. The Napoleonic Wars had ended and the sort of money had fallen out of the war economy, so there was a lot of unemployment. Also, income tax had been repealed, which I'm sure today we all think sounds like an absolutely wonderful thing, but I'm sure then as now, what happened was there were a massive increase in commodity taxes to make up the shortfall, which sort of put the burden quite heavily on sort of poorer people, particularly the Corn Laws, which were passed in 1815, which massively increased the price of bread. The employment market was flooded because of the repeal of the Apprenticeship Act, so a lot of previously sort of semi-skilled trades were now sort of flooded with people unemployed because of the war depression. And this really led to sort of a clamour for change, and a lot of people thought that the solution to this problem would be parliamentary reform, extending the franchise to sort of male householders universally. I don't think women really got a look at them at this point, unfortunately. And I mean, that was sort of a movement that was led by people like William Cobbett and Henry Hunt. And there's a pamphlet titled Address to the People, was printed by a radical called Joseph Mitchell. We find it in HO49/3, which is a collection of things found on prisoners, mostly pamphlets, satirical songs, stuff like this. And this sort of sums up the feelings of many quite well. So the writer remarks, this quote, "We found our cupboards void, our ceilings that once bowed with well-fed beef are now adorned with dried herbs and the ragged remnants of famished spiders." Goes on to say that the poor journeyman manufacturers are obliged to work late and early to get money to pay enormous prices for their food to cruel adulterators of our bread, who are at this melancholy moment poisonous with their villainy, under the pretense of enabling farmers to pay their enormous rents and, of course, keep up the splendour of the landholder. Now, I mean, the pamphlet goes on to effectively blame these problems on the landholders and the parliament, and both houses of parliament, which were obviously made up of landholders. And then he then puts out the solution is parliamentary reform, appealing to the Home Secretary, to the Prince Regent as a patriotic and loyal subject to dissolve parliament and extend the franchise to male householders so that a new government can be brought in. And he believes that this will cancel the national debt and sort of engender liberty. Which is a really nice thought. I mean, but there was a lot of this about. And sort of typified by things like the Hampton Clubs, which were effectively debating societies and occasionally fronts for secret revolutionary groups, as these things often are, which sort of advocated petitioning the Prince Regent and Parliament peacefully to try and get parliamentary reform. But the government were really quite scared of these people. They sort of had visions of France in the late 18th century, I think, which, you know, again, wasn't too far away. And so they decided, rather than trying to have some sort of dialogue with these reformists, they decided to sort of become quite repressive and suppressive and try and put them under with things like the suspension of habeas corpus. But actually, in some ways, this had the opposite effect. William Oliver, who was one of the most famous of the Home Office's secret agents at this point, who spoke to a lot of reformers, and we'll hear more about later, does in his account of journeying around the country point out that he did meet some people who said they were afraid to become in the reform movement because now they could be imprisoned without trial, they would not want to lose their families, so they would sort of step back. However, he also meets others that in consequence say to him things like, nothing less than a revolution would do the country any service. So I think we can see in some ways that there's a possibility that the government's sort of repression of radicalism may have actually caused it to become slightly more powerful. But now let's talk about the cataloguing. Now, the cataloguing of the HO40 is not particularly good, unfortunately. I mean, so we have broad headings, it's on digital microfilm, but there are a huge amount of papers, and we don't have a huge, particularly good idea from the catalogue entries on Discovery currently what's in there. Fortunately, though, the Home Office sort of did some cataloguing for us about 200 years ago by putting schedules in each volume. This is from HO43/1. So you can see you've got paper numbers there, and then dates and places of sending and who the letter's from. Occasionally you get a bit more detail about the enclosures. So what we decided to do is, in the case that we have schedules present, I mean, they're not always at the front of the volume for some reason. I once went through an entire volume cataloguing it myself and then found that the schedule was at the back and much better than mine. Sometimes they're in the middle, so they're difficult to find. We've copied them out and put them on Discovery, making them searchable by keywords. And obviously, in the case that schedules weren't present, we have sort of written, gone through the volumes or packages of papers and sort of tried to pick out keywords so they're hopefully helpful for researchers. So there again is the schedule. Now, this is what the old cataloguing looked like. This is the paper catalogue from a couple of decades ago. But you can see, I mean, so you get, this is HO43, and you've got the dates of the file here for the first bundle. And this gives you a brief heading, so it gives you the folio numbers here, so I'm blocking the screen. And just a really, you know, Cheshire, Lancashire, and miscellaneous. You don't really have an entirely good idea of what's in there, so you're going to have to trawl through the papers. But by copying out the schedules, we now have these full schedules here. So, you see, we still have the heading and the folio numbers, but when you have the schedule of the papers, this runs much further down the page. But you get a summary of each letter, the date it was sent, who it was sent from, and also, you know, the place it was sent from, and some idea of the enclosure. So we can then do keyword searches. So if I wanted to find out information about Jeremiah Brandreth, who was one of the leaders of the Penrith Rebellion in 1817, what I can do now is, using the advanced search function on Discovery, I can search for Brandreth within the series HO40, for the year 1817. Previously, I wouldn't have got anything, but now I get sort of, you know, well, three items here where I know that there are papers, and I know whereabouts in the volumes they are, papers directly relating to Brandreth. So it really makes the series a whole lot more accessible, and hopefully we'll get more people to realise how fantastic a resource it is and access it. So now I just wanted to talk a bit about the Penrith Revolution. So, I mean, the Penrith Rising took place on the 9th and 10th of June in 1817. So, at about 10 p.m. on the 9th of June, about 50 radicals assembled near Penrith, led by a man called Jeremiah Brandreth, and they began sort of going around the neighbourhood looking for weapons and further men to join them. Now, the Jeremiah Brandreth had told them there was a large force rising elsewhere, and they'd gone to take Nottingham and eventually London. And he continued to say this. Also, during the search around the neighbourhood, he banged on the door of a house. Someone wouldn't come out to give them arms or further men, so he shot through the window, killing a servant. So not an auspicious start. They then tried to take an ironworks, and despite the fact that they were about 80 armed men at this point, were repelled by four constables, so again, not so auspicious. And then, somewhat demoralised, head to the small town of Ripley. Sometime the next morning, once they crossed into Nottinghamshire, they were basically found by 20 dragoons. dispersed, and about 50 of them were arrested then, and the further sort of about 85 in general were actually arrested over the coming weeks of June, including sort of people who were considered to be ringleaders, so Brandreth himself, William Turner, a man called Isaac Ludlam, and their brothers Thomas and John Bacon, who were actually quite involved, but had their involvement sort of quietened down by the government because they'd been in contact with William Oliver, or Oliver the Spy he was known beforehand, who was the Home Office's radical agent. Now, this is Oliver's signature from his account, which is contained in HO40. And the authorities were quite forewarned of what was happening in Penridge because they knew something was happening because radical organisations throughout the Midlands and the North had been penetrated by agents. Oliver is probably the most infamous of this. He became the Home Office's agent in March 1817, offered his services directly to the Home Secretary. Basically, sometime before that, he befriended a radical called Joseph Mitchell, who's subsequently arrested in Huddersfield in May that year in London. And Mitchell takes a shine to him, believes him to be a radical, and then takes him on a tour of the country. So Oliver basically gets to meet radicals throughout the Midlands and the North. He travels through the latter part of April, throughout May, and then also in June, both with and without Mitchell after Mitchell's arrest. Now, afterwards, Oliver was sort of blamed for the Penridge Rising. It was considered that he'd inflated the idea of radicalism and sort of pushed men towards carrying out these revolutionary actions, overstated the strength of support for them in London and other parts of the country. It was said that wherever he went, he always said that support was greater in the place he'd been last. But this, in some ways, I think, well, E.P. Thompson, his Making of the English Working Class, and the sort of records do point towards it as well, is that, I mean, although Oliver certainly did exaggerate his own support and support in London and other parts of the country, he's not the only person doing it. He's not the single agent provocateur who comes up with this conspiracy. It's not entirely entrapment. There are lots of stuff in the records about other men considering, who are genuine radicals, considering and overstating their forces supporting them. For instance, Oliver attends a meeting of revolutionary delegates some weeks before the Penridge Rising, where delegates from throughout the North and the Midlands meet. And the gentleman from Derby says that there are 30,000 people in that county willing to support a rising if it happens. But we know now that when Penridge happened, there were about 80 men, and most of them were quite reluctant to actually come on the march. So it wasn't just Oliver causing this sort of disastrous revolution to happen, although he's definitely a factor. People generally wanted to have this revolution, I just don't think they were actually willing to go through with it. Now, HO40 contains a lot of documents about the run-up to Penridge and its aftermath and, you know, the thing that happened at the time. And certainly there are a lot of letters beforehand where magistrates and mayors throughout the Midlands and the North are warning the Home Secretary that they know and they've heard from their informers that there's going to be some sort of rising around the beginning of June. I just thought we'd look at a couple of them. So this is actually the original report of the Penridge Rising, which was received on the 10th of June, was sent on the 10th of June to the Home Secretary from the Mayor of Derby. And he says that because of reports of, and I quote, a simultaneous rising being expected, the magistrates and military are up all night on the 9th of June. He then goes on to say that this morning intelligence was received that the disaffected were assembling, that they had broken open several houses, and that one man has been killed. He goes on to say that the cavalry have been assembled to try and stop them, but that's all he can say at the time. This is the second letter, again to the Home Secretary, and this recounts actually the stopping of the rising. Basically, the writer says that he was informed by the Sheriff of Nottingham, that folk villain, continuously through English history, that there was a rising going on. So he rode on his horse, and he found them eastward in Nottinghamshire, and he saw them, then calculated them, rode back to Nottingham, collected 20 dragoons, because that's all he thought was needed, and then rode back, met them at Eastwood again, while they were still milling around, and then broke them up. And he recounts that he found them with 50 pikes and 20 or 30 firearms, but still they were no match for 20 horsemen. Now, the last document I'm going to look at is possibly the most interesting one we're going to look at today. It's a deposition from a man called John Cope, who was involved in the rising, although claims that he subsequently fled it. And this was taken on the 15th day of June, 1817, so a couple of days after Penridge, when he was a prisoner. And what I think is really interesting about this is it really gives you a sense of sort of the kind of journey that someone who was interested in reform might have taken in 1817 from sort of a peaceful interest, passing interest in reform in the pub, to being involved in some violent revolutionary action. Now, Cope attests that he joined the Hampton Club in December 1816, or thereabouts, he said about 2 months beforehand. And he recounts going to the first meeting, said he was sort of accosted in the pub and asked if he was interested in reform, ends up going to a meeting, they adopt some articles. And then he says that at the first meeting of the Hampton Club, the speakers said that they were not interested in, I think the exact words, not interested in robbing or killing, but they would find reform through a constitutional petition. However, soon after this, in the beginning of 1817, Cope becomes involved with Thomas and John Bacon, who are considered to be some of the ringleaders of the Penridge Rising. And they tell him, take him to one side, that they're putting up a petition, but they also inform him that there, and I quote, there would soon be a general insurrection. So obviously they're already planning for this. Now, Cope also details the night before and the morning of Penridge, which is really interesting. He says the night before, just before the rising got up, he travelled to Penridge, found a meeting where they were discussing various arms being collected. He says he became scared and he returned home, and then he was by himself until about 3 a.m. when the mob came through his village and banged on his door and came and got him out. And he said, and I quote, that the mob were armed with guns, pikes, and a many swords. And then he says that he went with them until about 8 a.m. the next morning when he fled. But there's some interesting things, and I think, again, this sort of shows that the radicals massively overstated their own position, because apparently during the march, a man rode on horseback at a gallop from Penridge and announced to the mob that he had been to Nottingham, that the town was all their own, the soldiers being fast in barracks, as the officers would not let them out for fear of their joining the mob. There's a lot of talk about soldiers joining these revolutionary mobs at the time, but it never seems to happen, unfortunately. And apparently also during the march, it was announced to the assembled mob that once they had taken Nottingham, which they would use as their headquarters before forming up with a larger force and going on to London, once in Nottingham, all public property would be seized, the national debt extinguished, and no taxes. Which, it sounds nice. And they were hopeful men, but unfortunately, they were not successful, and a lot of them met, quite unpleasant ends. Now, this is the Home Office's criminal register for the year of 1817. It's actually a special page outside of the normal county structure for people who were tried at Penridge. Overall, 24 were tried, and most they were tried for high treason, to be made an example of. Now, a few were imprisoned, a couple were found not guilty, and most were sentenced to death, but had their death sentences commuted to transportation for life. Thomas and John Bacon, who were sentenced to death, but then transported for life, as well as George Brassington below them. But the three people who were identified as ringleaders by the government, so that's Jeremiah Brandreth, Isaac Ludlam, and a man called William Turner, they had their death sentences carried out. And in fact, they're actually the last people in Britain to be sentenced to being hung, drawn, and quartered. Bear in mind, this is, the early 19th century, and it's a very medieval punishment. However, they were sort of in some ways lucky. This is just actually George Waitman here, who Bryony will talk about. And again, he's sentenced to death, but it's commuted to transportation for life. Now, they were given some sort of reprieve from the Prince Regent, actually. This is a letter from the Home Office's private and secret entry book. It's a warrant from George, signed by Viscount Sidmouth, the Home Secretary. And he decided to grant them clemency so that they would be, instead of being hung, drawn, and quartered, they would still be drawn to the place of hanging. They would still be hung. But they wouldn't have their bodies cut into four pieces. They just had their heads cut off. So he's a kind of medieval ruler. So, yeah, I hope you've sort of learned a bit more about the kind of cataloguing and sort of how hopefully we're going to continue to make this fantastic resource more accessible for researchers through discovery. And I hope you've sort of enjoyed my mildly grim tales about Penridge. And now I'll hand over to my colleague Bryony, who will talk a bit about criminal petitions.
Hi, I'm Bryony. I work as a record specialist in the same team as Chris. And we were discussing in the office what we're going to talk about today. And I got quite infused by the tale of Oliver the Spy and the Penridge Uprising. And I thought I would see if there'd be anything in the records that I work on this case as well. I work on a record series called HO17. Again, they're Home Office papers. And I manage a team of volunteers who are cataloguing this series. I'll just take you through what I did to try and find material in this series, because it will kind of illustrate the work that we're doing and why I think it's important. So when Chris told me about it, I didn't know the names of any of the men involved. I have to confess I hadn't really heard about the rebellion before. So I did remember, though, the word spy and that they were convicted at Derby. So I thought I would do a catalogue search on those terms. And as luck would have it, I did find some material in HO17. Concerning George Waitman, one of the men involved. This particular document has been catalogued, which is why I could find it, and you can see we can be reasonably confident this is our man. It mentions the spy system, the dates seem to tally, so it looks like a good match. What I want to do is use these papers to illustrate how useful the cataloguing of HO17 is, and why it might be of interest to a wide audience, including those interested in 19th century criminal, social and local history, as well as people who are searching for individual criminals. Before I do that, I thought I'd just explain a little bit about what HO17 is and what the series contains. The documents are criminal petitions for mercy dated 1819 to 1839. This may not be something that we're particularly familiar with today, but on conviction, it was possible and even common to petition for mercy on behalf of a convict, to ask for either a full pardon or for a reduction in sentence. The prerogative of mercy stems from common law, with criminal prosecutions pursued in the name of the king or queen. As a prosecutor, the sovereign also has it in his or her power to pardon the criminal. From its creation in 1782, the Home Office dealt with petitions on behalf of the monarch, and by the early 19th century, this was actually quite a large part of its business. Any sentence could be reduced, and the petitions in the archive range from petitions against the death penalty to asking for a reduction in fines. So it's a wide variety of crimes and sentences dealt with. The process of consideration varied between those tried in London and elsewhere. So those tried in London, the monarch would actually sit in council and discuss the case. For people tried elsewhere, it would all be discussed via correspondence. So what would happen is that most of the evidence on which consideration was based would be testimonies given at the trial, the judges' notes, and any fresh information provided by the petitions. The petitions vary considerably in size, detail, and style. You might find a single letter signed by family and friends, or there might be a large bundle of correspondence with supporting material. Petitioners are generally seeking mercy, not justice. So they set out mitigating circumstances to explain a criminal's conduct or to elicit sympathy. Common themes run through the petitions, unemployment, sickness, poverty, age, respectability, and so on. And such details can provide much-needed contextual information about a crime and about an individual's life. They can add colour to the often quite dry information provided in government papers. So, for example, someone claiming that being in prison is damaging their health might include a report on their health by the jail surgeon. Or someone claiming that they're actually very respectable might include character references from friends, local employers, clergy, and so on. All of these details add meat to the bones of records like the criminal registers that Chris showed earlier. And they provide a rare opportunity to see events from the point of view of the ordinary person and to learn more, a little more about their lives beyond the information in trial records. So returning to George Waitman, who is convicted for his part in the Penrith uprising, the catalogue entry is fairly detailed, as I mentioned before. And this is a fairly good example of what the volunteer cataloguers are doing. This is an example from the document, and if you look at the document, it provides information trying to justify Waitman's behaviour. In 1831, someone called Robert Goodacre, a public lecturer in astronomy, wrote into the Attorney General on George's behalf, asking whether mercy might be extended and a pardon issued. Goodacre sets out mitigating circumstances in his letter, stressing Waitman's naivety and his limited culpability. He writes, "Being found, I suppose, with arms in his hands and in the train of Brandreth, he was convicted of treason. But his friends state that he had no part or lot in the matter, but was dragged out of his bed and compelled to go with his former companions." That kind of ties in with the descriptions Chris was giving. Goodacre knows Waitman's sister and her husband, and he describes them as prosperous, as devoted friends to the liberal cause, and as respectable in morals and manners. So he's trying to build up a case of someone who is respectable and has respectable connections. So Goodacre also highlights his own respectability as a lecturer and tries to establish a personal link in the letter, mentioning that one of his friends was at school with the Attorney General. So all of these nuggets of information are kind of trying to build a case that Waitman has good connections and that if he is pardoned, he's going to have a network of respectable connections and friends who will keep him on the straight and narrow. The Attorney General forwarded the letter to the Home Office, and the clerks working in the criminal department entered the letter in their register of correspondence, they're assigning it a kind of a reference code in order to find it again. And just as the clerks navigated their system using these references, so do we when attempting to find records that haven't yet been catalogued. The record series containing the registers is HO19, and this is an example from 1831. The series is arranged by date and then by surname letter, and it provides the name of the convict, obviously, and then where the trial took place or where the person is writing from. So that's why you find the names of the convict hulks there, or, as in Waitman's case, New South Wales. You also get an indication of the result of the petition. So FP is free pardon, so it's good news for William Wilson. Nil is no, so George Waitman obviously not successful this time. This is the key information, the reference code, the letter and number code. And that's how we would have found this paper if it hadn't been catalogued. The registers get a bit more detailed as you go on, and this is from 1834. As you can see, it gives you information about the trial and other notes. And as you can see, in 1834, someone again wrote in about George, and you can get a lot more information here to definitely confirm this is your man, and another correspondence reference. And looking at this, this is in a document that hasn't been catalogued. So this is what the series looked like in the past before we started working on it. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. You need to have looked at HO19, and that's a speculative search. Waitman was tried in 1817, and I found papers in 1831 and 34. So that's a lot of registers to trawl through. So that's why we're working on this series. It's a shame that it's difficult to find the material, because this is the entry in HO1770, which is the second papers for Waitman. And it's sent in on his behalf and the other men involved. And again, it stressed their naivety. It stressed that they've actually kind of become more respectable. It says, "We believe that being inexperienced and ignorant, and moreover in great distress at the time, a complete ascendancy had been gained over them by the insidious acts of the authors and promoters of the insurrection, and that seduced by the inflammatory statements then uttered, they were led to regard the government as the cause of their sufferings and were stimulated to acts of hostile violence. We trust that the dreadful experience which they have now had of the rueful consequences of their criminal conduct has worked in them a deep and abiding contrition." And it worked, and they were pardoned in 1834. So 17 years after they were convicted, these rebels have received a full pardon, and they were free to return home. Waitman didn't. He stayed in New South Wales until he died in 1865. So what are we doing to make these records easier to find? They read through every piece of correspondence, every report, every letter, and pick out the key information. Having done this, the catalogue entries are much more usable. So you can search by name, by crime, by place if you're doing a regional study, even by the occupation of the criminal. And this, we hope, kind of opens them up to a much wider audience. HO17 has 131 pieces containing an estimated 20,000 items. And when you remember that an item might be one letter or a huge bundle of correspondence, you get an idea of the scale of the project. So far, we've catalogued just over half, so we're well on our way to opening up the series. By capturing the detailed descriptions, we hope to open up the records to a wide audience. The registers are time-consuming and cumbersome to use, and as many people are unaware of the petitioning system at all, let alone how to use the registers. HO17 itself is sadly underused, and it is a very rich resource for early 19th century history. It was only having speculatively trawled through 3 years of registers that I happened to find the happy ending to Waitman's story. In the future, users will have a much easier time piecing together the Home Office archive. So I just want to thank my volunteers for their cataloguing work, and I wanted to highlight just how important this is in opening up this vital series. Thank you.
This podcast is copyright to the National Archives. All rights reserved.